Welcome to Foreign Passion, episode 58. I want to continue to thank everybody that joins us every couple weeks. And I want to thank everybody that joins us on our paid feed as well. So if you're getting three a month, you're a part of that team. For those that don't know, we have a Patreon feed. We're going to get an additional episode of this podcast on the last Friday of every month. You can go to www.patreon.com/forum of passion and subscribe there for $2 a month. You're going to get also access to every episode we've ever done on the Patreon feed as well. And so there's good stuff going on over there. It's a lot more discussion-based as opposed to individual-based, so you're going to get a bit of a dynamic between the main feed and those episodes. We also shout out every person that signs up over there on the main feed. This week, we got one new Patreon subscriber, so please join this esteemed person. We have Mr. Zachary Acosta-Lewis, otherwise known as Lee, sings in the band Division of Mind. He was in Hard Stripes. He does a noise project as well. That I'm sorry, Lee, the name eludes me right now, but you can text me, I'll say something about it. But today we have on an individual that I have, and I say this with a lot of truth behind it, have had the pleasure of knowing for I guess over a decade at this point, and have really enjoyed watching his main project rise and his personal success. And, you know, I can't say enough good things about the guy. I wish I saw him more. Brendan, how you doing?
What's up, Ace? Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate the kind words.
Of course. I mean them. I mean, you know, I was thinking about it today. And yeah, I remember, I guess I would have met you sometime in 2010 at my old house. I don't think we had met each other before that.
The legendary basement, garage basement? Yeah.
Yes, it was a basement.
Very small.
About 60 people could fit in there.
Yeah. Well, that's a stretch. 60 people did fit in there.
could is maybe being liberal. I remember seeing you guys come down, came in the minivan. High respect.
On that rolled move. In the minivan for many years, dude.
I mean that. So, and that's the thing. And we're gonna get into this because I think that's something that is super interesting about the popularity of Incendiary, but y'all's operation has always been one that I feel has been, for lack of a better term, just like streamlined. Just like, you know, it's like, you know, I've always known as big as y'all's shows are, you're always rocking it in the minivan, you know, kind of like Bare Necessity style.
Yeah, it's kind of how we rolled. I mean, a lot of it was just like you said, out of necessity, trying to be as efficient as possible, but also like, you know, not really expecting anything.
Yeah. Of course. I mean, and so that in itself, I think is one thing where it's like, I've talked to you about it before where it's like, you know, talking about like, sort of how many eyes, you know, get on your band and the energy that you've kind of given me previously has been like, we didn't plan for this. This is just kind of what happened.
that's very accurate. Yeah.
So are you, I mean, you know, I've always known you as a Long Island guy. Are you originally from Long Island?
Yeah, born and raised. I'm from Smithtown, which is kind of like dead center Long Island, North Shore-ish. So I didn't move. I grew up in the same house that, you know, like since I was born.
Is that 631 or?
That is 631. Okay. Excellent question. Wow. Okay. Yeah, 631.
I know.
You know, by this point, you know, yeah, because Long Island's kind of a, you know, it's a thing. So folks know.
Around the same time period that you and I met, as I would go up and like play at like Kaz's house on New Year's.
Yep.
There was always discussion of people's area, the two area codes on the island. You know, and the rivalry. So I whenever I meet people, someone from Long Island, that's my first question.
Yeah, it's kind of like a fake beef, but it's fun. And it's just like a product of like Long Island's so populous that like your town, let alone your county, I guess, like is just kind of like your world and your like black hole. You know what I mean? Like I feel like growing up, and maybe this is a pre-internet thing, but like, I didn't have friends from other schools. Like Smithtown was my world. You know what I mean? Only later did you meet people from like outside of your town.
Right. And actually that's important because, you know, like I think this will get into some stuff that maybe like some younger listeners aren't as privy or experienced to of kind of like discovering subculture when you don't have access to everything.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that shaped a lot of things. You know what I mean? I hate like being the back in my day pre-internet guy, and I try not to be, but like, it's hard to ignore that was like a dramatic difference between then and now.
You talk about like being kind of part of like the bubble and there in Smithtown. What was Smithtown like? Like kind of like what was your environment like, you know, as like a young person?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was relatively normal. I have two older sisters, and so I was like the youngest kid, kind of by a lot. I have like my one sister's 9 years older than me and my other sister's 5 years older than me. And so I think it was fairly normal. I think I was kind of like a very imaginative young person, like liked like exploring and doing weird things. And I mean, the two major things that I was into as a kid was playing the drums and riding BMX. That was kind of like my entire life. And I spent a tremendous amount of time just like, you know, I think a lot of people, I think still honestly, but like in the woods, like digging dirt jumps, like I spent a disgusting amount of time doing that. And that's like what I think about the most when I think about my childhood kind of.
Oh, dude, of course. And you said you spent a lot of time like playing drums. How did you get into that? And at what age?
I my neighbor played the drums, and I just thought it was like so sick from the moment I saw it. And then there was like, you know, like school band, like that started in, I think, fifth grade for us. And I had always intended to play the drums, and like my friends at the time all convinced me to play the cello. And I did it for like a year, and I was like, man, why did I get sucked into doing this? This sucks. The cello sucks. So like that summer, I told my mom, I was like, I don't want to play the cello. It stinks. I should have played the drums. I want to play the drums. So like I took lessons. And then like I did like school band, like that whole thing, playing the drums. And then I got like, I hacked together, like I got like a snare drum. And then one Christmas, I got like a secondhand drum set, probably like seventh grade, sixth or seventh grade. And that's kind of what I was like obsessed with.
You know, you talk about like kind of like fifth grade, so about 10 or so age wise. That's always when I find that, like, speaking to a lot of people on here about the time period, they start kind of like cutting their own mold of their taste and like what they're into. Previous to that, what were you like, what were you listening to, and like, where were you finding music? Like, why did you end up wanting to play the drums around that time?
Yeah, I think, well, the cool thing about having older siblings is, I mean, if they're, you know, if you have a decent relationship with them, like a lot of times you can be influenced by some of the things that they were into. And my oldest sister, we spent a lot of time, she went to school in Indiana. She went to Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. And we drove there from New York always. And it's about like 15 hours, or at least it took us 15 hours. And we used to like bring like a boom box basically, and just jam it in the back of the minivan. And so my sister was really into like early U2, like good old U2. And okay. I like grew up loving that. And then this is kind of specific, but like we used to stop at the same rest stop in Pennsylvania, and they had all this like kitschy, weird, like records and vinyls at the truck stop. And I used to buy random tapes on my way, like out to the college, just when we were dropping her off or picking her up or whatever. And then I would jam those on the boombox. And I remember getting like an early Red Hot Chili Peppers record. I don't know which one, like one of the older ones, like the pre Blood Sugar Sex Magik, whatever. And then some other random stuff. I got the Streets of Philadelphia soundtrack. Very depressing. I don't know how I wound up with that.
What, like, was on that?
It's like a Bruce Springsteen song. I think it's Streets of Philadelphia is a movie with, I should know this, It's about a guy who gets AIDS. It's a good movie. I think is it Tom Hanks?
Philadelphia.
Yeah, Philadelphia. Yeah, sorry. Philadelphia is the movie. Streets of Philadelphia is the song.
Okay, got it.
Springsteen. I don't know why I remember that, dude, but we used to get that. And so like I got into some of that, and then my middle sister was into like all kinds of cool shit and used to listen to like the Lemonheads and Letters to Cleo and some hard, like heavy stuff. And so I got into a lot of music from them. And then basically I heard like Smash by The Offspring, and that kind of like changed my life.
how had you found Smash?
My friend down the block, shout out Dan, had the CD. And I remember very vividly listening to it in his room. And the song Bad Habit came on when they say, "You stupid, dumb shit, goddamn motherfucker." And like absolutely blowing our minds. And we would like play that part like over and over and over. But in the beginning of that, so that was like one thing about it. In the beginning of that record, I think the song's called Nitro. The record starts off with this like drum roll. And it's like, and I remember being like, how could anybody do that and play the drums that fast? Like play a punk beat like that.
Were you already playing drums?
Yeah, but it was like nerd school, like tappa tappa, like snare drum, bass drum stuff. Okay, like I wasn't really playing drum set. You know what I mean?
Gotcha.
So I remember hearing that. And then like we listened to like, from a lot of the Punk-O-Rama stuff, like I got into Pennywise, and it was the same kind of thing where like, how does the dude play the drums like this? Like, this is insane. And I used to like sit in my basement and try to play like a fast beat and just be like, this is impossible. Like, and that's kind of like some of those albums really like jumped out at me, both from like a punk side, but also from like a drum side, like at the same time.
Were like people like that you were friends with, were they into the same stuff? I mean, I guess you were listening to this stuff with some of your friends, but like, was it just like a couple or was like, did you have kind of like a unit of people with you that were like all into the same things?
At the time, I had friends in school, and like I had a couple friends who like we rode BMX with, and we were all kind of into stuff. Like my buddy Dan, who I grew up with, is like, you know, one of my best friends, and we would go and get like the Punk-O-Rama comps, and so like 5 years on the street or whatever they're called, like the comps that you would get at like in the mall, mm-hmm. at Hot Topic or whatever.
Oh yeah, I remember.
Or I'd like say, yeah, I'd like, you know, some of the Sam Goody or what have you. So people were, I mean, this is jumping ahead a little bit, but there was only like a couple people in my high school that I knew of that were like into stuff like that. And yeah, I think we had a little bit of a crew, like a group of friends that were all kind of into punk and from Smithtown and hardcore and pretty much all of them, honestly, I'm still friends with, which is kind of cool.
That's cool. That's very cool. The reason I asked this is because I'm like, okay, we're, you know, you're playing like in like school band and stuff and you're starting to hear this punk stuff, but like, is there any inclination in your mind? Are you like, I want to play in a band, or is it just kind of like, are you approaching drumming just from like the sake of drumming?
It was at the time it was drumming for the sake of drumming. Like it's funny you ask that because like you'll hear stories of like, oh, they were 17 when they put out this album. And I was like, man, my band when I was like 18, let alone 17, was like so bad and like couldn't do anything. Like I always think of like Cave-In. I think they were like 18 or whatever when Until Your Heart Stops came out or something.
Are you kidding
me? That
was
not my experience, dude.
I had no idea they were that young.
I think for the first one, they were pretty damn young. I mean, Jesus. A lot of bands like...
I mean, yeah.
Right? Like just crazy shit. Like,
I mean, whether you No Warning, Cro-Mags, what have you. Like,
yeah,
all,
yeah.
The,
let
all
alone
the classics.
Like, you know, the Youth of Today stuff and yeah. and yeah. like Siegler playing drums when he's like 13 or whatever. But yeah, but yeah like... That wasn't really a thing. I probably wanted to do it, but I didn't know. I don't think I knew anyone who played the guitar until like later into high school.
Oh, interesting.
So like in middle school for sure. I was like starting to get into like going to shows and learning about like local scene, which we can talk about. It had like a massive effect on me, but not from like a playing in a band perspective per se.
Well, let's talk about that then, because that was going to be my next question. Was kind of like, okay, so if you haven't met anybody playing guitar until you're later in high school, like, but like you're, I mean, I was going to ask, are you going to shows? You indicated that you were. What shows are you going to? How did you find them? You know, like what was going on?
Yeah, I was aware through through friends and from maybe seeing like flyers in the mall, but there was a band from my town called Subterfuge, which was like the be all end all for me. And Subterfuge, actually Rick from This Is Hell, from Soldiers, from Extinction AD, who's like a great dude, like legendary LI guitar player. He played drums in Subterfuge.
Okay,
and cool. So I knew of him because we went to the same school, but he's like, I think he's probably like 3 or 4 years older than me. So I was aware of them, and two things. Number one, they played at the mall, like in a store, which I went to, which was one of my first shows. This was probably like, had to be like 1998 maybe. And then they used to do shows down the street from my house in this basement, where it was like their friend's dad owned the house and no one really lived there. And they used to do shows in the basement. I used to remember like riding BMX and like hearing them practice and being like, oh shit, like that's Subterfuge, and kind of just being like a weird like creep, like hanging around their house. So I was aware of the local scene. I had another friend who was going to shows like at this like sketchy bar, like a couple towns over, but I didn't really like, I didn't know what the hell was going on. Like I had no real way to learn about shows that were happening other than chance, like two friends or going to this one local record store that would like post flyers sometimes.
Okay. So, I mean, and you're saying like, this like you're about middle school age in 1998, correct?
1998. I think I'm like eighth or ninth grade.
Okay. All right. Well, so the reason I asked is because tying back into what we talked about earlier, like there's not like internet to be like, here's a resource for where shows are, like a MySpace, you know, but that would come later, or like even like a Facebook or like, you know, obviously like let alone something like an Instagram. So it's like, you're just kind of having to find this stuff in the wild, so to speak.
Oh yeah, dude, you're lost. You have no idea what's going on. Like none. It's so funny to me now, like looking back on shows now that everything is archived so well, and seeing like unbelievable shows that happened on Long Island and being like, oh, I could have went to that. I didn't know that happened. You know what I mean? Like I had no idea that show existed. And it was like a couple towns over. Later on in high school, like there were like Long Island hardcore message boards and stuff. By that time I was kind of like in college, but yeah, I mean, I didn't really know too much about what was going on. I started to, as I got more into like 10th, 11th grade, there were a couple venues that like I knew had shows and we would get flyers there. And there were like these proto, like I said, like hardcore boards. It was called like the Long Island Zoo board or whatever. But before that, I was just utterly ignorant, just having no idea what was going on.
So other than seeing Subterfuge, what other shows from this time period do you remember going to?
Oh man, let me think. Most of the shows that I would go to were almost all local shows.
Okay.
Like Tension would play, or that band On the Rise. Do you remember On the Rise? I think they put out a record on B9.
The name is very familiar, but I don't remember specifically.
Kill Your Idols would play.
Sure.
And then the band that had like the biggest impact on me was a band called The Backup Plan, who like had a minute and were touring a lot. They were also kind of like proto This Is Hell. The time that I grew up in Long Island, Ace, was like post Silent Majority. So like post VOD, post like insane 3,000 people at a VOD show in 1997, like that kind of thing. So there was a lot going on. It was just like a lot of local shit. I think I remember seeing Most Precious Blood. But I remember going, like every show that I remember, they were like all local shows, like Heads vs. Breakers, or like Fall of Icarus, or like A Love for Enemies, like all those bands are from Long Island.
Oh, I've heard of that. That last one I've heard of before.
Yeah, Love for Enemies was like a Christian hardcore band.
Yes.
That was like in that whole lane. Actually, one of the guitar players from that is like now one of my best friends, which is kind of funny. But like, it was just like a melting pot of weird stuff. And then there was like some more like punk, pop punk stuff, like at this bar in my town that I would walk to. But there wasn't a lot of like, I don't remember going to a lot of like national touring acts. Part of the reason for that is, at the time, obviously, I didn't drive. And so to convince my parents to drive me like 40 minutes to drop me off at some like sketchy bar that like largely didn't always go over so well. So it wasn't until that like I like got a car, or a friend would get a car, that we could go like do shit. And we would go to this venue called the Local 7, which was on Long Island. And that's where I saw like a million different shows.
Well, no, I mean, and that's the thing, is that like you're pretty confined, you know, before I feel like when I was that around that age, my life was, there was my life before being able to drive and my life after, just because you couldn't, you know, like you couldn't go anywhere. Like unless your parents took you someplace, like you were like, okay, well I can like, if I can bike somewhere or like walk down the street to something cool or like maybe catch a ride from a friend. But otherwise it's like, you're just kind of stuck.
It is kind of like this weird hole. And I was like doing other shit too, and like into a lot of other stuff. I do remember seeing Gray Area really early on at like some random bar, but it was like I said, just kind of like ignorance, you know, like I would buy records like literally sight unseen. I remember getting the Indecision, Shy Alude split, because like I thought the cover looked cool. And then I got, the whole reason I found out about Strife is because I saw someone wearing their Southern California straight edge. No, I saw a Southern California straight edge, like that one with like the Japanese characters, like in a store, in a record store. And I just bought it because it was sick and it had like a sick live shot on the back, but I had never heard them in my entire life. And then I was like, all right, I probably should check out this band, because even in my young age, I knew this was kind of a poser move. And so I remember hearing them and being like, oh shit, this is like nuts. Like that was one of the first non-local things that I could remember. I mean, that's really it for me. And I don't know if this is like, maybe this is unique, maybe it's not, but like I was fully entrenched with like local bands. Like that was good enough for me. I didn't really have a sense of like the national hardcore touring circuit at that time.
You know, I know people here that I've grown up with that are also like that, but it's a rare thing, I would say.
It is. Yeah. And I think part of it is, I mean, there were a lot of active bands and we like had the venues to do so, right? If you grow up in town X and everything's at, you know, whatever, Steve's Bar and Grill, and it's like mostly 18 plus, like, that's the place where you can go. But I was going to shows at VFW halls and all that kind of a thing. And so it made the step in like a lot easier, which is why you have to have like an all ages venue to really like grow a scene, because like the hardcore shows at bar thing is fine for like me now in 2021. But when I was growing up and for kids, that's not like, in my opinion, the best environment for hardcore shows or for getting into hardcore, at least.
I completely agree. I mean, like, you know, it's like, I have had conversations with people that are like, oh, I want to do this show at X venue, like locally. And I'm like, I mean, you can, but that's a 21 and up club. And so it's like the, you know, it's like, are there like less people then when, say, you and I were coming up that are like high schoolers at shows? Maybe. But at the same time, it's like, don't cut that option off. And also, most of the energy at a hardcore show comes from the youngest people in the room.
100%. I mean, that you can get away with that stuff if you're more of like a metal band, and yes, B, you're playing like in Brooklyn, like whatever, 21 plus in Brooklyn, by and large, it's not the end of the world. I still don't like it. But it's not like the end of the world.
You can do
21 plus on Long Island is that straight up sucks, right? Because you're talking about the burbs, you're turning away kids, and that's just not it. It makes it difficult to have a lot of like new people and new faces at shows.
Precisely. No, I agree with that. And that's the thing is, yes, you're doing a metal gig, no big deal. Like,
yeah,
you're getting a drinking crowd, like fine, well, you know, whatever. But like if you're trying to grow stuff, you need to start from the ground up. And so that makes sense that like so many things locally were just like so appealing to you because, you know, it's like you talk about VFWs. Those are like perfect all age show venue locations and everything. So that being said, when you eventually, well, actually you mentioned something earlier that I put a pin in mentally that I wanted to get back to. You said you were into a bunch of other stuff. What other stuff were you into at the time?
Yeah. I mean, like I was just like always into, I always had like a lot of interest. I mean, I can't understate how much time I spent like riding BMX. Looking back on it, it's actually incredible how bad I was. Like you expect me to be like you see kids now and they're so good. And I was so bad. And I did it every day for hours and hours and hours. And I was like, I would do that. I was really into playing roller hockey at that time. Okay. I would do that all the time. I don't know, man, playing video games, playing like the Simpsons video game on my PC, like shit like that. Like kid shit, like suburban kid shit. You know what I mean? Like I was just kind of doing it all.
Yeah. I mean, but of course, I mean, like, you know, I've always known you as someone that's pretty eclectic and balanced in their interests. So, I mean, like, it makes sense that you started out that way as well. Do you still do BMX at all?
No, I didn't. I kind of started to get into it again in college. And then I got to stay around it because like a buddy of mine who like I lived with for a while in Brooklyn, Adam, like ran this huge BMX website called Come Up. Mm-hmm. And he got like, so I would like stay close to that. And that was fun. But like, I kind of like fell out of like riding. I sucked at it, man. I sucked. Like I tried to skate too. But I don't know. It wasn't for me.
I was the same way. I like tried to skate because like friends of mine skated and stuff, and I just suck at that shit, dude.
Yeah, like, I'm like such a fan of it. It's so cool to me. I love the culture. I love BMX. Like I really do like it. But I was like, yeah, you know what? I can just be a fan from the sidelines. I ain't good at this stuff.
Okay. So as you mentioned earlier, you. Actually, I'm kind of curious. You're into all this stuff, and you're experiencing like the local fanfare of shows and everything. What was kind of like your high school experience like in general? Like, did you enjoy school? Like, did you hate it? Like, you know, how did you gel with kind of like the world away from subculture?
I didn't hate school. It was like fine, I guess. I think, let me think. I mean, it was something that like, so both of my parents are teachers. Mm-hmm. And I kind of grew up in a home where like, that's kind of what you did. Like you would have to go to school and like do well in school. And I always did like, okay for it. So it wasn't really the kind of thing where it was like, I thought about a different option or like, I felt it was instilled in me from a young age, essentially, to like do well in school. Like that, sure. And from such a young age, where it wasn't like wasn't an option not to. And it's not like my parents were not super strict or anything like that. But it was just like, oh, I have to do this. I have to do well. I want to do well. I mean, the other thing about me is I am a hyper competitive person, like extremely. Mm-hmm. And so even in these things like school, I was kind of just like, all right, like I want to do good. And it was kind of like a game to me. Like I wasn't like necessarily like a huge nerd, but like I tried to do well. But I was always like, I made friends who were as much as I could, like into the same shit that I was. I had a good group of friends that would like, as in like three, that would like, we would drive to shows, we would go to shows on the weekend, we would hang out at each other's house and like check out different records and stuff like that. And then I was like, you know, in doing the drum shit in band and made friends through that. So I always kind of had my hands in like, or irons rather, in a lot of different fires. I think I got, you know, some parts of school were like hard. I was like always like a chubby kid and got teased a lot. And so I think I got a lot of like I got in a lot of fights and stuff like that. And so there were some things that I didn't love it, but all in all, I don't think it was particularly terrible for me.
I mean, man, I get it. I was the same way. You know, I was overweight in school and that can cause a lot of just like, you know, kids are mean, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
It's not like every day that you're like, you're an adult person and like, you're like clowning on fat people, you know? So
yeah, dude, and like high school and middle school especially, but like high school, like that shit is war. It's straight up war. Like it's like survival of the fittest, and you learn to kind of have like a tougher edge. And you know, I would get into fights and get beat up kind of, and like just be always kind of like watching my back and shit. Like it makes it sound like I went to school in the South Bronx. I didn't. It was total white bread suburbia, but like, you know how it is. Like it can be tough. And for, I think, a lot of people to just like make it through school. When I look back on shit now and I see what kids have to deal with, and like, you know, as an adult that like everyone's hormones are raging, kids are insane, you don't know what the hell's going on. Like it's just such a wild environment to look back on, you know?
Yeah. Just, I mean, you really are, you're throwing like a bunch of wolves in with each other.
100%. You
know, like,
100%.
The most raging time period in someone's life, and you're like, hey, all y'all be together.
Exactly. And also, like, I don't know if it's how it was in VA, but like, get up at like 5 a.m. every day and be in, like, I don't get that shit. Like, I woke up so goddamn early for school, and school started so early. And that's when I've had people ask me about this before. The number one thing I remember about high school is being tired all the time.
So I didn't have to get up wicked early. Like I got lucky there. I played football in high school though. And like one thing about it is that like how they treated it was like, all right, I was played three sports in middle school, and then how tired I was from football mm-hmm. when I got to high school, I was like, I can't do two more seasons of sport. I was like, there's no way. Like
it's insane, you know, looking back on going to like waiting around for like practice to start after school, and it's like 4 o'clock, and I'm pretty sure I got up at like 5:30 or something like that every day, and then I want to say first period started at 7 or something, like crazy early. But yeah, I played football in middle school, but at the time, it's actually kind of funny, like middle school football is weird, right? You played it too because of like puberty. So yep. You have like some guys that are like basically men and some that are like children and yep. boys. And I like kind of developed late. So I would get the absolute piss beaten out of me in football in middle school. Like I wore glasses. So like I rocked like rec specs under my helmet.
Oh shit. Okay.
Yeah. So like, you know, it was a rough scene at that time, but yeah. And then I did some other shit like in high school. Like I threw the discus and like, I got into lifting weights and shit like that. So that was a cool time and kind of like a fun group to be around.
Yeah. I got into lifting like more seriously. Like I was doing it in middle school, but I got into it more in high school. And that was probably the most, like I do it most every day since then. And that's probably the most fun time period I've ever had with doing.
Yeah. There was a lot of stuff about that in sports that I like doing. I thought it was cool.
But, okay. So you're extremely well-rounded at the, you know, like at this time, and everything, like it's in a positive way. It sounds like it's drilled into you. Like you're supposed to do well in school. You're competitive. You're, you know, like you're involved in your local scene. You got, you know, like BMX going on and everything. Like there's a lot of things on the resume here, so to speak. You say you meet somebody like someone who plays guitar later in high school. Is this somebody that you would end up playing with, or was it just kind of like a doorway into a different world?
No, like I got, so I, our, my first band started probably like either the end of my junior year, the beginning of my senior year. And it was just all through kids in Smithtown that I had met. One kid played the guitar, one kid played the bass. And then my friend Jared, who, like I went on to do some other bands with, he sang, and we were pretty bad, but like we played like mostly house shows and like house parties. Mm-hmm. And it was actually a ton of fun. And so I think we played the Battle of Bands in high school, like true, true, like American Pie shit, basically.
Oh, yes. Oh yes, I know the vibe well. What was the band called, and what y'all sound like?
So the band was called The Unthinkables.
Okay.
There was a lot of tension in terms of our musical direction, because we would basically, the guitar player was really going more for like a Descendants vibe.
Okay.
And so picture like a lot of like really simple, like Descendant style pop punk songs, and then me making the band cover Force of Change by Strife. And okay. That was essentially what our sets were like. So it was a little all over the road, to say the least.
Yeah.
Because at that time I was like straight up trying to do HC shit 24/7. And so we had some creative differences that kind of ended The Unthinkables, but it was a good time. I still have a t-shirt, actually, our first t-shirt.
High school bands tend to be, other than the examples that we cited earlier, but high school bands tend to be, I feel like, otherwise just all over the map. It's people finding new influences and being like one guy wanting to do one thing and one person wanting to do something else, you know? And instead of being like, well, let's zero in on one of these, it's like, let's just try to do all of them.
Yeah. And this was like, for context, this was the beginning of the heights of Blink-182. So it was a lot of like visors turned upside down with frosted tips and like extremely long shorts type of vibe for most of the local band stuff. And like,
yep.
There was like the classic like high school band that was like more pop punk, and they were crushing it. And our band would be all salty, like, man, like, you know, trying to play like, you know, punk and stuff like that. And so the pop punk train kind of missed The Unthinkables, but we probably should have jumped on it. I probably would have gotten more chicks or something.
The fit you just described is like such of an era. Like, I was like aware of, like, at that point in time, like I around this time period, I'm in middle school. So I was aware of what you just described, the visor and frosted tips person.
Yeah. I don't think people understand like how influential Blink-182 was to people. Like, I mean, they're fine. I Dude Ranch when I was a kid. It was cool. But I think for people who like try to figure out a lot of people kind of like between my age and your age, right? Like about what their influences were, and they're like wondering where certain bands come from, or like the whole deathcore scene, which doesn't seem like it has any roots. Like Blink-182 influenced all of alternative music, basically. Like that's what every single kid, I feel like, particularly after like the generation after me, like wanted to be like, wanted to play. I remember all the drummers would have like the Orange County, like Travis Barker, like flat drums and shit. I distinctly remember like how there was like Blink-182 mania, I feel like, you know what I mean? Like at that time.
Definitely. So I'm kind of a hater of them, but from like a context of this, they were so inescapable.
Oh, and 100%.
Like, kids at my school that were like not alternative type kids at all, that were just like kids, kind of, we talked about like kids that were like not so cool to me, that was like all their favorite band. Like they, like Blink-182 was top of the pops in like the early 2000s.
Straight up.
And like, I think, so what it is friends of mine that are like a little younger than me. So I like the generation, like you're a generation above me. And then the people that are like generation after me or whatever, they don't know, they like heard Blink-182 and like, they're like, oh yeah, it's cool. And I'm like, y'all missed just by a little bit the time period where like you probably heard them on the radio like 20 times a day on like a low end. Like,
this time with them plus MTV TRL, like playing, you know, them and like,
oh, yeah,
Newfound Glory and like Taking Back Sunday and Brand New, and being from Long Island and watching those bands just like explode. Like it was just a crazy time in music. And that's why like, this is sort of tangential, but like, that's why like all of those bands, like they can draw so many people. It's like there was like this label interest in whatever you want to call it, pop punk, like whatever, mm-hmm. like type of music, and those bands just got massive. That's why like Newfound Glory will still draw, 1,500 people and stuff. That mass reach of MTV, man, that shit is no joke.
Yeah.
How successful those bands got from that.
That time period, Newfound Glory, Sum 41, Blink-182. Oh, like
huge.
Like Offspring too. Like even though you mentioned them much earlier, they had like a boom during this time period as well.
Yeah, and I have to say, like, I'm a pretty big, the Offspring obviously got pretty wacky, right, to say the least. If people have not listened to the first two Offspring albums, I highly recommend it. They still hold that. The Smash is unbelievable. I believe it's the best-selling independent record of all time.
I think I've heard that too.
The one before that, what the fuck is the first one called? Oh, I forget. It's great. It's great. It's just like straight up punk. And yeah, I'm probably biased because I got into them so early, but those records still rock.
I'll take a listen right after. Cause I'm kind of curious too. Cause I remember like Pretty Fly for a White Guy and stuff. And like The Kids Aren't All Right. I remember that era of them.
But yeah.
Like,
this is before that. This is Keep Them Separated and like more.
Oh,
like
that sounds good.
Yeah. It's, I love that shit, man.
You do this band for The Unthinkables for like how long?
Probably like a year and a half, maybe.
Okay, so you're probably just towards like the end of high school.
Yeah.
What was kind of the game plan for you post high school?
So it's the same kind of thing where like it was just assumed that I would go to college. Mm-hmm. But at that time, both of my sisters had gone to school. They both went to pretty good schools. And so that was just what I had to do, or what I planned on. Like it wasn't just looking back on it. Wasn't like, what am I going to do after high school? It was which college am I going to go to? And so it's kind of a long story, but I wound up going to the University of New Hampshire, which is pretty random. But so I went there, fall of 2002.
Okay. So you end up, going there and like, did you just kind of slide in like easy? Did it come simple or was it like, kind of like,
No, I hated it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Here's the thing. I had like a great summer between high school and college. I was just like, all I cared about was like music and hardcore. And by the way, like by that time, I had gotten more exposed to like two major like styles of music. Like the first one was, I think it was my sister dated someone or something, but there's like this CD case, like, the CD books that were left at my house. Oh, and sure. Like they had, that's where I got like turned on to more of the, like more like, I don't know what to call it. Not just like New York hardcore, but I got into like Floor Punch from that. See, I remember listening to the Floor Punch record. I know you're a big Floor Punch fan.
Favorite
band. I got really into Fast Break from that. Okay. And then I learned, I checked out some of more like the classic records, some War Zones, some stuff like that. So I kind of got schooled into like the non-local stuff. And that was probably like 10th grade or something like that. And then the second thing that happened was my sister got me a compilation and I know this is backtracking a little bit, but like eighth or ninth grade called Nowcore, which was this like comp of all like the pre sort of like the second wave emo. So like your Promise Rings, your Braids, your Texas Is the Reasons.
Oh, sure. King, okay.
Right. Which I was like, I kind of didn't mention, like I was like obsessed with that all throughout high school.
I didn't still know that. Right?
And so going into college, I was kind of like hitting the ground running, being like super into both kinds of music. But New Hampshire was a big change. I didn't like know anybody, and it's a super like homogenous school. And so one of the things about UNH is like, it's pretty like frat sorority dominated.
Sure.
And that wasn't my thing. So I never feel like I found, especially in the beginning, like I kind of didn't really find my place, so to speak. But I did kind of get involved with like booking stuff and like at the radio station. And I met, like a friend of mine who I'm still cool with, this dude, AJ, shout out AJ, who was like a lot older than me. And he would, we would go to shows in mass at that time.
Okay.
And that was really cool because I kind of got to experience like a completely different scene. You know what I mean?
What shows were you going to in mass?
So at that time, I went to a bunch. I distinctly remember going to like, I went to Back to School Jam, I think, one of them, 2002 or 2003, I think. And then I went to Skate Fest, which was at the Palladium. So I was mainly going to the Palladium. Later on, I would go to shows in New Hampshire. I remember seeing like Blacklisted, Think I Care in New Hampshire. And then I think I went to see Drug Test once. Ooh, okay. Shout out Skull. Love Drug Test. And yeah, but the funny thing about going to shows in mass, particularly at that time, was Long Island was not a violent scene. It just wasn't. Maybe it, you know, like pre my time, I'm sure it got a little lit during Neglect and stuff like that, but it really was not a violent scene. Going to shows in Boston from Long Island, at that, now I'm like a full on fan, Converge guy, HopeCon guy. And so I go see the HopeCon for the first time and I'm just like absolutely terrified. I just remember people getting like thrown down the stairs of the, have you been to the Palladium?
In Worcester, yeah.
Yeah. So like there's the upstairs is like there's steps that lead up to it, basically like directly into the dance floor. Mm-hmm. And so I remember like kids getting like thrown down the stairs and shit. And it was like complete anarchy and it was so much more violent than I had ever experienced. And I was like, just holy crap. Like, so that was an interesting experience. And it was cool to kind of like see a completely different scene, but it was definitely a jarring experience from like a wimpy kid from Long Island.
This is like 2003 or
yeah,
later.
That's the pocket. 2003 to 2002 to 2006. I was at school and that's where I was like fully immersed in the scene up there. So seeing like Converge did this show at the Middle East upstairs, like after some crazy long tour. And it was like them, Cursed, Backstabbers Incorporated, and somebody else. That show was, I distinctly remember that one. And then a lot of those Skate Fest shows, it was like the one where AN played. And at that time they were like American Nothing. And they had like American Nothing merch. And they played in like a Transformer blue. And so like everyone, they like finished their set just like with the crowd yelling. I remember that. So like they were all
fucking
cool.
Good at that time. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh dude, it was nuts. So like I got to see a lot of cool shows around that time.
This is so interesting. I never knew you like spent time like up the way of New England and what an interesting time period to also experience like mass in Boston.
For sure.
Cause that's like Boston has had like a few different peaks, but I think this one is like a really high one for sure. During this specific era, like, you know, and also you know, kind of like the juxtaposition of you're going from like Long Island, you know, being like one type of scene, one type of energy to going there, which, you know, is just like peak aggression, I feel like at the time as well.
It was different. I mean, but I just felt like the hardcore scene was just like, it felt a lot bigger up there at that time. I think Long Island, you know, in the like 2007, 8, 9-ish time period, like 2005, 2006, like it, in my opinion, had a little bit of a lull. And I wasn't really into a lot of the like more melodic, like quote, fun hardcore at the time. And that was pretty big. And I mean, it was big in mass too, honestly, right? Like that's kind of the home of it. But like, there was like an eclectic mix of stuff. And so it was a good experience. I like made a lot of friends that I'm still cool with. Like, I really did like kind of being a participant in that at that time.
Did you play in anything when you were up that direction or?
Well, the funny thing about that, and this is kind of where it starts with like my fits and starts, I guess you would say, but like what I would basically do is come home in the summers, hang out, you know, stay and like be at my parents' house, and we would start bands, and then we would play shows, sometimes go on like a short tour. And then I would be like, all right, I have to go back to college. And then be like, all right, well, we're going to get another drummer. And I'd be like, yeah, that makes sense. And then I would go back to school and I would start a band. And I'd be like, all right, well, like I have to go home for the summer. And they'd be like, all right, well, this isn't going to work. And I'd be like, okay, that makes sense. So like, it was kind of a frustrating time. I played in two bands in New Hampshire. And then I played in a couple bands in Long Island during that time period.
What were each of these bands and kind of like, what was the energy around them?
So I'll do the New Hampshire bands first. I played in this like wannabe Taking Back Sunday band with all kids that I didn't know, that like I legitimately like almost like a classified ad style thing, dude. I don't even remember how I found out about it. They were called Ambry. I think they got like signed for a while and like had like a tried to tour and like had a minute. That was cool because like it like wasn't a hardcore band and like girls were coming to the shows and I was like, all right, this is cool. It was a little too pro core for me. And I wouldn't like quit college to do it, which looking back on it, I think was probably the right move. So like we parted ways during that, with that, which was, you know, maybe for the best. And then I played in a band, in my latter years there called Roid Rage, which was fucking awesome. It was basically like, have you ever heard of that band Iron Monkey?
Oh, dude, hell yeah. Like, okay. Kind of like sludge style, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Huge juxtaposition. Yeah, poor segue from Ambry. Yeah, it was kind of like that, like kind of like Iron Monkey worship, Crowbar-ish. And that ruled. We would play shows around New Hampshire, and the singer was this like dude from Maine, and he was like a power lifter. And there were a bunch of like big boys in the band. Like I was definitely by far the smallest one. And at that time I was like a total beefcake. So it was real good times. Then
respect. I like this. I like the thematic action of this band.
Yeah. There's some funny Roid Rage pictures that I'll try to dig up. There's definitely someone Return to the Pit. Shout out Aaron, the Rev, on Return to the Pit from that time. We'd play like UNH and shit like that.
Okay.
Yeah, and then in Long Island, I did a band called Since You, which was cool, and I liked it, just like fast hardcore. And then I did a band called Up the Fury, which we played, and then we did this tour in the summer of like 2005. And that was pretty funny because it was like a self-booked tour, but we wound up jumping and opening on multiple dates of the... let's see, it was like Shattered Realm, Ramallah, Suffocate Faster tour.
Oh shit. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And we were like five dorks playing like fast hardcore, opening these shows. We like jumped on like down to Florida. Definitely fun, funny, a lot of good experiences. Got to hang out with White Trash Rob, who was the legit nicest, coolest guy to us the entire time. Lot of violent shows, a lot of dudes not feeling Up the Fury in our tunes.
Yeah,
but it was pretty fun, honestly, and funny. And so that was like a cool experience. And Up the Fury kept going. They got another drummer and they actually put out like a full length and they toured kind of a lot, and which I think is kind of cool. So that was what was, and then I did like a bunch of other little like random projects and stuff like that.
What were the random, just like, you know,
I would play with umbrella. Some of my other friends in high school that were more into the like, you know, brand new side of things. Right.
Okay.
Which was like massive. And we would jam. I don't think we really had any like bands per se, but we would try to put some stuff together. I forget some of the band names, but one band recorded two songs, I think, or one, just, you know, brand new, like that kind of stuff, whatever you want to call it, like Long Island emo stuff.
Sure. I know the exact energy.
Yeah,
definitely.
And it was cool. So I got, you know, I did a lot during that time, but it was sort of, I guess you could say, frustrating.
You know, what's interesting is that it's like, you know, you're obviously known as being a singer now, but you're not singing for any of these bands, are you?
No, I'm playing drums for all of them.
You're playing drums for all of them. Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm looking forward to when we kind of the point where we get to the jump. So you, by the way, before we kind of like go to the next phase of your life here, what were you in school for again?
I majored in anthropology and in history, but anthropology was like my main focus.
What was the plan? What did you want to end up doing?
I was planning on being in and like getting my doctorate. Okay. Like I was full on that was the plan. That's why I went to that school, because of that program. And so I wound up basically, I wound up kind of finding my place at college, because I started playing rugby, which I know you were a rugger for a while. So rugby, like for people that don't know, like it on its surface, let me back up. In the UK and some other places, it's like for rich kids. It's like kind of a snobby private school sport, right? In the US, there's a little bit of that element. I didn't go to a private school. There were some dudes who went to like private schools in Boston that played rugby like legit in high school. But what I found is they were a lot of like cool dudes who like wanted to play a rough sport and like drink beer and get in fights and like listen to metal. And that was right up my alley. And yeah, so
pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. Like I kind of like, I loved it. And were there some like, ex-football player frat guys, like 100%.
Yeah,
but most of the dudes were super cool, and our team was really like serious, and so it kind of like it let me have an outlet, and I made some friends, and I kind of scratched my competitive itch. But then I wound up playing rugby like after I moved back to New York and stuff, and I loved it.
You know, when you were talking earlier about what your school experience was like, you more than anybody I've ever had on here, I was like, oh, I lived this exact thing. I went to school that was super Greek, like 65% Greek.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was not really, that's not my vibe. I found the rugby team. Because I had played football, but I didn't really like love it, but I played it for like 7 years just like because it was kind of an expectation in my family, you know, whatever. And yeah. And I did like the aggressive nature of it, but I was like, oh, kind of what you were just talking about. I was like, I want to play something that's like even like harder than football, something that's like more dangerous than football. I found it that way. On the other end of what you're talking about, I did go to a private college, and it definitely was like a lot of like rich kids playing, but also the joke about my team when it started. Like I got there, and I was like, "Oh, I've seen rugby. Like people get fucked up. I like shit like that. Like I want to play that shit. I want to fuck people up. So I want to play that." And I joined the team, and like I would tell people like around campus, I'm like, "Yeah, I'm joining the rugby team," and they kind of like smirk and give this like look a little bit, and I was like, "What?" They're like, "Well, what we've heard is it's mainly a drinking club that kind of plays rugby."
Yeah.
And like, you know, I've never drank. So I was like, oh, I was like, well, that's kind of a bummer, but I guess we'll see. And I remember our first match, they like, we scored a try, and the dudes on our side are freaking out. And I'm like, what's the big deal? Like, and they're like, oh dude, we didn't score one try last season. And I was like, God, dude. But, by the end of it, we were like, we got good enough to where we bumped up from being a varsity, from a club program to a varsity program. Had like, I think one of our seasons were like undefeated. So it really like switched around, you know, whatever.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, that's the funny thing about rugby in the States. Like pretty much every college has a rugby team.
Yeah.
But it goes from like you were saying, like a drinking team to yep. like serious. Like our team was like pretty serious. Like we would play all the Ivies were in our division, and then we would play the Army and just like roll up to West Point and get straight up smacked.
We're all D1.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so we would get murdered. So that was kind of funny. But yeah, man, like it was cool. Like, I don't know. I liked that element of it. Like I said, I'm a competitive person. Mm-hmm. I liked it. I would have for sure transferred somewhere else if I didn't start playing.
That's literally, I say that all the time. I would have transferred back to, even though I was only an hour and a half away from Richmond, I would have transferred to like VCU here had it not been for the rugby team. I got like into that to a point where I was like, I like this enough and I'm into this enough where I want to do this. My school was really small, so we were D3, but we would occasionally play like UVA. We would do D1 sometimes. Yeah. I don't really know how that worked out. We'd do okay, but then like I remember like we'll move on after this, but I remember there was like some story where one of our dude, we would like UVA had a D3 side and they had their like regular D1 side. And one dude in our team like went to party at UVA or something like one weekend and talked all this shit about their team for whatever reason. So when we have a home game where they come play and they're like, we had smashed their like D3 side before. So we're playing them and like first half we're like, dude, they got really good. Like, what's the deal? And we found out that because that kid had talked all this shit about them, they sent their D1 team. And we find that out like halfway through the game.
I love that.
And we're like, fuck. Like, we ended up like I think we were tied at the half and like lost. Like, you know, once we figured out that we were like actually playing like a really hard team, we're like, oh shit.
But amazing. I loved sport. It. I met a lot of cool people through it. I met a lot of like interesting, cool people. I think sort of like not maybe what you would expect as someone who is perhaps not familiar with the sport.
You played for a men's club afterwards, yeah?
Yeah, I played when I mean, so after college, I moved to New York City, well, to Queens, which is New York City, to go to graduate school. And I kept playing. I played for an all Irish team pretty much in the Bronx, which was just like so much fun. And I loved it. It was like a whole thing.
You're a hooker. Yeah.
Yeah, I was. Yep. For most of my career. And then like when I started to get thinner, I played flanker. But yeah.
You know, respect on being a forward, you know? So
yeah, my back, feel it every day basically from that position.
Oh dude, I'm fucked up, man. Like, I know that like that did so much damage to my back. I hope yours is staying intact, but, so you go to grad school and I mean, are you still pursuing your doctorate at this point?
So that's still sort of the plan. I never really, as I soon found out, I never really had another plan or thought about this too much. I guess I have a kind of a difficult time verbalizing it because that's just like what we did. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go to school. And then the intention was like, I guess I'll just keep going to school because like, this is what I've always said that I was going to do. And so I figured out what I wanted to do, like school in terms of like what school to go to. And so I wound up going, you know, I wound up doing this like master's program at Columbia, which was cool, intense. And I liked it a lot. And so at that time I was just like living in Queens and going to graduate school and like trying to work, because New York is expensive and graduate school is expensive. And so it was kind of like a wild time, but, oh, and playing rugby and going to hardcore shows. So it was a wild time for sure.
I mean, but there again, kind of sounds like you in high school, you're doing a lot of stuff. You know, the plate like seems to be always full. Like where were you working at to kind of like, you know, like make money this time period?
My sister got me a job at her, she worked at a law firm, works at a law firm. And she got me a job as like a filing clerk, like, pulling files and like putting them in order, like pretty like menial stuff. And so, but that was out in New Jersey. So I used to have to like commute from Queens there. And sometimes I would like sleep on her couch. So it was just like a wild time. I kind of like a jack of all trades, master of none. I feel like I burned the candle at both ends a lot of times. And so that was definitely a time where I was doing that. And even with school, like, I mean, by the time I finished, and was like working on my thesis, like I was just out of gas, man. Like I was straight up out of gas on the whole school thing.
What was your thesis on?
It was on the Hindu puja ritual done online by like immigrant families. It was actually like, it was actually kind of ahead of its time. The whole concept was basically about like, what is the, how do you like practice religion online? And like, does it quote count the same as like going to a temple or something like that? So I was into like cultural religious anthropology. And so that's, that was the focus. So yeah, I spent a tremendous amount of time reading about that.
What, I mean, did you end up like, were you end up saying like, this is a valid practice or like kind of like,
yeah, kind of basically like it was about the I mean, this is getting pretty like straight nerd stuff, but like it was about the concept of like materiality and like what is real and what is material basically. And so it has a lot of like, you know, a lot of stuff comes up about it now, but I did, it was interesting. And I did a lot of stuff on like new religious movements and cults and stuff. So that it was cool. Like I really enjoyed my time doing it. I just got super burnt out on school, like at that time.
Well, dude, I mean, you're in grad school. I mean, I don't doubt it, man. You're a master's program, but I mean, it's like, you know, I hear people like, you know, post grad school or like, you know, like post undergraduate, like sucks, you know?
Yeah.
I got a dude with me right now working on his master's and his life sucks.
Yeah, it's tough. I essentially what happened is I was in class and going to school with kids who were in the doctoral program, and this is what they did. They ate, slept and drank this. And I just like regular liked it. Like I was like, I'm interested in this and I'm pretty good at it. But these people were, this was their life and their calling. And it's the kind of thing, pretty similar to like some other fields, I would say, like maybe like being a doctor or something like that, where like, this is what I want to do. This is what I was like put on the earth to do. And I was absolutely not like that. And so when I was looking into continuing it, it was like 7 to 8 more years and I'd have to learn 2 foreign languages. I was just like, I don't have the desire to do this. And so I just, you know, I graduated and stuff, but I was like, all right, I think I'm done with academics. There's a lot more stuff to it too. Like academics at that level is kind of weird and like insular and like who you know, and there's a lot of like weird stuff about it that wasn't for me.
Well, one thing that's kind of interesting about academics at that level is that everybody I know that kind of gets, or not everybody, but a majority of people I know that are like getting academics at that level, I feel like they like never leave the academic, they never leave academics in a weird way.
Yeah.
Like I have like, you know, I have friends that are like professors and people that are in like master's programs or doctorate programs, and like you are just in school until you're like 30.
Oh, dude, absolutely. And the thing is we're doing the social sciences, it's basically like the most amount of schooling for the least amount of money, the least marketable skills. Like it's not like, if you're going to school for, let's say, chemical engineering, you get paid like a decent amount of money and you can get a great job. Anything involving like philosophy, anthropology, English, sociology, like those are the soft sciences, and it's a little bit more difficult, and you really have to love it.
Oh, I mean, you have to love it and you have to zero in. I majored in English because I thought I wanted to be a teacher. And I'm not a teacher, you know, like,
yeah, I found that out too.
Exactly. So you finish up this and, you know, like what, like, you know, like you don't want to do school anymore. Where are you going now?
So at that time there was like a 4-year, 5-year period where I got a job through graduate school for this like startup where they just kind of wanted like generalists. It was like in kind of a hard thing to describe. It was basically like doing like taxonomy. So like if you think about like how websites get classified, like stuff like that, like, or if you think about Amazon where it's like the soap is under home care products, like stuff like that. It was like doing what's called natural language extraction. And it was like this kind of like basic job. And it was my first job. It was in the city. I was able to like make money, like some, which was the main thing. And then at that time, like, I didn't really take it seriously. I was just basically driving to Long Island, like, constantly to, like, hang out with my friends, who many of which didn't go away to school. So it was just kind of like, in a lot of ways, I was like, all right, I'm back to New York. And I knew I wanted to get back involved in music in some way, shape, or form.
And see, this is interesting too, because it's like most people I talk to, it's like you're already, like, you know, you're done with, like, post undergraduate and everything, and like you're still, like, going to shows and stuff like that, but you're in what I imagine is, like, your mid, you know, mid 20s.
Well, yeah. So I finished graduate school in 2008. Mm-hmm. So I was probably like, I guess I can't do the math. It's too late. I guess like 24 or something like that.
Yeah. And you're not, but you, at this time, because you're so busy, you're not playing with anybody, are you?
No, not really. No, actually I would have to be younger than 24, because I was 21 in 2006. Yeah. Like 22, 23, whatever.
That makes sense.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, this is kind of when Incendiary started.
Okay. How did Incendiary come together?
Basically, I was singularly focused on starting a band, because when I was away at school, I was just seeing my friends back home on Long Island doing bands, doing whatever. And I wanted in on the action, basically. Like I was mad salty about it. So, I came back, but at the time I was living in the city and all my friends were, on Long Island. I was like, all right, I'm not playing the drums. Like, this isn't going to work out. I can't keep my stuff in my apartment, and like, I should just sing. And I had kind of tried to, like, mess around with it a little bit with one of my friends. We were kind of doing like a rock band style, or what, not rock band, garage band style, like, band. Like, he was, like, really good at recording stuff. And so we were messing around with that. So, like, I was thinking about doing vocals, but it was straight up out of convenience. That's basically the only reason.
Okay. So you know, you're making the trips back from, you know, like, Manhattan, you know, to back to Long Island, and meeting up with these guys. You said this is like about like 2006, 2007.
Yeah. It's Incendiary started in proto Incendiary was like the summer of 2007 with, you know, mostly guys that I grew up with that went to Smithtown, and the guitar player, Brian, not Brian Audley, this other dude was in a band called Invade, which was like a short lived Long Island band. They were actually sick. They put out a split with Die Young, but they were like playing kind of like that 90s style, which was obviously exactly what I was into. And that was the lane that I wanted to do. So that's kind of how I put things together. My friend Dan Turr played bass, and I got him. I knew him through shows, and like, I was kind of making connections. So we had a couple iterations of it, but that's by and large when it started and what we were doing.
You know, this is interesting too, because around this time period, 2007, 2008, you're not really seeing bands going for that type of style.
Definitely not. It was not a popular form at that. 2007, 2008 is still like kind of the more melodic style, right? Like, there were a lot of good bands going on, but there was still like a little bit of the sort of Mental Righteous Jams stuff.
Yep.
And that was really popular on Long Island, like a lot of more of the melodic, like I said, like two-steppy kind of hardcore, which wasn't really my thing. And so, no, it wasn't the kind of like genre or subgenre, if you will, that was like, I look at how things are now and people have taken it to such an nth degree of 90s worship that, like, I mean, personally, I'm in heaven about it because I love it, but it's so funny to see that being kind of in vogue now.
Well, because at the time you're talking about like you're in the melodic era is ending right about this time period, and the like New York hardcore, like, but not in a lock and out way, but the New York hardcore worship is like about to start, like
100%.
Your TUIs and your Backtracks are happening around this time period. Like starting out, you know?
Yep.
And
exactly.
But even, so that's an interesting thing too. Cause even still Incendiary kind of leans more to the latter of the two things I just said, but you guys were still like a different thing than that as well.
Yeah, I think, I mean, especially early on, our lane was Snapcase, you know, Strife, Indecision, and like stuff of that ilk, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, like victory stuff and stuff.
100%. Yeah, victory stuff. Yep.
So you know, you guys come together. Like when does the demo come out and when's the first gig?
The demo came out in 2007. The first gig, I want to say it was like in August of 2007.
So real quick.
And then we put out a 7-inch in 2008. So like right around that time, we had like an almost 100% turnover. And so a couple of the guys, like, I mean, and I wasn't hating because that was kind of, that was used to be me in a previous, you know, band, but
yeah, sure.
They were like, yeah, this is like not really like what we're trying to do here. And they were actually moving out of state. They were moving to Boston, like three of the dudes. So I like eventually put, you know, we got some other guys, which more or less is what the band is now.
So, which is interesting. So, you've pretty much been the same unit for over a decade at this point.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. The core four, really, of like me, Brian, Dan, and Rob, and Matt, our bass player, has been in the band for a while at this point, too. But yeah, I think the four of us have been in the band since 2008.
Was Kevin the one before on bass before?
Yeah. Kevin was. Shit. Well, it was Dan Turr and then Kevin and then Matt and then yeah.
Okay, got it. Because I think I met y'all sometime around when Kevin may have still been in the band.
Yeah, shout out Kevin Faber.
Yep, shout him. He lives in Atlanta now. I want to say.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay, shout him out. Yeah, I think he does. So you guys start how. You know, we talked about this a little bit earlier. Is there a plan, like, or is it just like we're just gonna play local, or kind of like what's the goal here?
Yeah, I mean, whatever the opposite of a plan is, that's what it was. Yeah. Honestly, man, like this does sort of tie into the beginning of our conversation. Like, I was singularly focused on being a part. quote unquote a part of the scene on Long Island. That was my goal. I wanted to play on shows that I would go to and like get booked on shows and be on Long Island hardcore flyers. And like, that was my sole aim and focus.
Okay. So it's step one is you're trying to cement yourself as part of the contemporary Long Island hardcore scene.
Yeah. I just wanted to be in it, right? Like, I mean, I spent a couple years out of state kind of like being a little bit jealous, like almost living between two worlds, not almost, like actually literally living between two places. And I felt like, Brenny's back, baby. I'm on Long Island. I want to play. I want to do stuff. And I was ready to rock. Like, I wanted to be in it. You know what I mean?
The man jumped up from behind the kit and said, listen to me. how did people, you know, did people take to it like you know, like off the bat or like kind of like what was the early stages like?
Yeah, I mean, the early shows, no, people didn't take to it. Could have been a combination of not being good, which is extremely possible, and the fact that like that really was not in vogue whatsoever.
Sure.
But We put out our first 7-inch in 2008, and like we started to get a little bit of a reaction for that, and it was like kind of slowly picking up a little bit. It took a while, but we did start to latch on like a little bit, and you know, like some bands were really good to us, like This Is Hell and Soldiers and Crime and Stereo, and like we got to open a couple sick shows really early on. I just saw this flyer the other day from like 2009 or whatever of like Crime and Stereo, Title Fight, Blacklisted, like the sickest lineup on Long Island. And we had opened that show, and that show was the first show where like people like cared, and we're like singing along. So that was a pretty cool time.
Hell yeah. I mean, like, you know, you've at that point had already, you know, done what you set out to do as, like, you know, being a part of, like, you know, like the local contingency. You know, so be it as that is like the first goal and there's not really a plan, you know, and you're working like full time,
working full time playing. Well, no, at that time I stopped playing rugby, living in the city in, I guess at this point it would be like, you know, I was living in Brooklyn, and just driving out. I used to like drive out east basically on like a Wednesday night for practice, like every week, like single, just doing the band, working, hanging out with my roommates, like, you know, living the life.
Okay. Sounds honestly outstanding.
It was like, it was a great time, man.
Like a great time period.
It totally was.
So, you know, you're doing this. Is Incendiary getting out of state at all at this point?
So here and there, I would say, like, so we put out our first record in 2009, our first LP, and that was like the epitome of just, like I said, kind of burning the candle at both ends. And that recording process was basically work all day in the city, take the train all the way out to Long Island to have my dad pick me up, eat some dinner, drive to the studio in like Eastern Long Island, stay to the studio until like 2 a.m., go home, get up at 5 a.m. to get on a train to go back to New York City to do the entire thing again. And so it was pretty brutal at that time, trying to do this all. But like, you know, it was our first record. We were like self-funding it, everything at that time. You know how it is, just kind of like hacked together. You have no idea what you're doing. And so we put out the first LP, and that felt good to have like a real thing out. And then after we put out the first LP-ish, we would get the Jersey offer. We would get Albany in particular. We would get the one-offs. And so that's kind of where the minivan came into play, because we were just like, yeah, we were figuring this shit out on the fly. But I guess the thing that was different for us is it wasn't the kind of thing where like we were building up so much demand where it was like, all right, man, like we can get a full US out of this. We can get a tour. Like it was so gradual that it didn't have that feel to it. And I think at the same time, like a couple of the other guys were touring and stopped. And so, you know, they weren't really planning on like hitting the road again, so to speak. So it didn't really unfold itself as like an opportunity at the time. And looking back on it, like we didn't, if more opportunities presented itself, we maybe would have thinking about doing more, but it wasn't necessarily the demand. Like the demand was not there, basically, said bluntly.
Right. Right. No, I get it. And, you know, one thing I'm curious about. So you said the demand's not there like to do like a full US, but you were able to do a full length record. So, I mean, did y'all self-release that or kind of like, how did that come about?
It came out on this label called Eternal Hope Records with this, I think it was based out of DC or Virginia.
Interesting.
And yes, they did put out a couple things. It was one dude. And they folded very shortly after they came out. But our objective at the time, and I don't know if this resonates with you, was like, I would like a physical record to exist.
100%.
As in a literal piece of vinyl. Mm-hmm. I had no idea how that worked, what to do. That was our objective.
You've done a 7-inch though, yeah?
We did. Yeah, we did. We did. We had, and that was on Eternal Hope too. It was the same kind of thing. Like, okay, it existed. And that for us, that was like, hell yes, check the box. The record came out. So it was a little laborious at the time and a little crazy, but it existed. Like, you know, that's what happened. And so, yeah, we were lucky that this dude, Chris, showed interest in us early on and made it happen.
Okay. All right. Cause I was always curious about, about how kind of how that came, like the first record came together, because we're going to get into the second record at some point, which ends up being quite the springboard. So you know, during this time period, 2009, you've got the first record out. When did the splits come into play?
The splits came between the first and second LP. Right. I think it was like something like 2010, 2011, or 2012, like in a row, something like that. And that was basically, we would get offered to do a split and would then go record songs. Like, it was very, just even talking about it is funny, because like it was so the opposite of, like I said, like being premeditated. We would be presented with an opportunity and then we would do said opportunity. But we weren't like, we didn't have some crazy master plan. So we got the opportunity to do a split with Suburban Scum, which went over great. And Suburban Scum at that time, they had played a couple shows, and I remember hearing their demo and being like, oh, this rips. Like, I love this. And so we got in touch with them, and then we kind of hit it off with those guys. And so it was cool to have the split done with them.
Yeah, they were extremely popular at that time period too. So it's like, you know, like y'all have your own content, y'all have your own kind of like fans, but then like to get lumped in with them at that time period as well, probably pumped y'all up.
Yeah, it was fun because we got really cool with like the Jersey crew and like RTF and Pat Garrity, and like we'd go out to play like Warren and stuff. And so, I mean, basically at that time we were playing like as much as possible, like multiple weekends a month, and just like doing as much as we could. And we would basically just say yes to every show. But what wasn't really happening, I guess, is like the concept of like, let's plan like a 2-week tour. We would just be like fully reactive. Like, we got a show offered in Albany on the 14th, and then we got a show offered in Western Mass the next month, and then we would have two shows like that. That's kind of how it was. And then we'd play Long Island, you know, like every other month or whatever. And then we started playing the city and a lot of like sketchy shows in the city and stuff like that. So it was kind of just like on a rolling basis, and it was fun, man. It was a lot of fun.
That. I mean, it's just like, you know, approaching it as like, all right, well, like we're going to show up where the request is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Almost literally anywhere. Yeah. A lot of bad shows, but like a lot of fun. We got hooked up with these dudes in Ottawa, like in Quebec, and would drive up there and play there randomly all the time, and had a lot of fun doing that and playing like pretty beat shows up there, like super far away. And we would do that in the minivan, and like, yeah, man, it was just kind of like hanging out, doing whatever.
Cool. I mean, that's just the best, dude. And what makes it even better from a poetic standpoint to me, you guys doing this stuff, you're having fun, you know, you're just like doing what y'all want. And then later, I mean, I think now y'all would have to try to have a beat show, you know?
Yeah. Like, it makes everything a lot sweeter, to put it mildly.
For sure.
It's, I have a lot of, I'm very cognizant of how things are now. You know what I mean? Because I think now, like, there are bands that come up that like have not played a bad show. You know what I mean? Those bands exist. And I think that was not the case for us. So it makes things feel really good. Number one, because you are just impervious to kind of a bad show. You just like don't give a shit. And number two, it makes the good shows that much better. And I think it was just, you know, at that time, just loving doing it. It was kind of a lot of work, just keeping things going early on. Honestly, it was like a little bit difficult with like making sure we had members and stuff like that. But once we had, you know, that core group of people, we were pretty rock solid. And the other thing was that like we were all on the same page. So I guess the other aspect is sort of like the like economics of New York City. Like, I was paying rent to live in Brooklyn, and it's not Brooklyn, not like what it was now or what it is now, but you know, it was expensive. Like, I kind of had to work. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't really like the like, and I like, I don't know, for me, like, I wasn't moving with my parents. That was not an option.
Fuck
no. So I kind of like had to keep some kind of gig, to make it work. You know what I mean?
Oh, I mean, of course, I mean, it, you know, as especially dude, this time period, so many people are doing the full US.
Tons.
I feel like everybody. And shortly after, like, you know, like around this time period is when my old band started, and like same deal. Like, I was post school. I'm not moving back in with my parents. One dude in the band had two kids. He's not taking, you know, time off from work to take food out of their mouth, you know, for this. It was like, so you just kind of did what you can. Whereas everybody else, by comparison to Incendiary, is just hitting it hard. Like, you know, they're out for like a month, 2 months.
100%.
You know?
And I mean, I obviously, like, we get asked about this all the time, and I've thought about it because, but I think it, like, we weren't like, we're for some nowhere town, like trying to see America. Like, that just wasn't my mindset. Like, yeah. I was so, like I said, Long Island had such a good scene, and there were so many people, and between Brooklyn and Manhattan and Long Island and Jersey, it was, to me, man, like, it was an embarrassment of riches. Like, I was doing it. We were playing the gigs. Like, I didn't have a concept of, like, trying to, like, make it, I guess.
Yeah, bands,
like,
are coming.
I was
here,
already,
like,
you know, yeah, I don't know if that makes sense, but, like, I was already so psyched on how things were going that it never really occurred to me to be like, let's keep pushing it. Let's keep going. Let's do it forever. Like, I was like, why? We're playing hardcore shows every weekend and it rules.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
That's gratitude. You know?
Yeah. It was good. Like, I guess I see how it is looking back on it, but it was, I think at the time it was a combination of not the demand and just having a great time and like legitimately loving it and being thankful for it. So I'm not trying to have like being like overly earnest about it, but that's honestly what the vibe was.
No, I get it. You know, so you during this time period, you guys are just kind of doing this. You're working to, you know, like keep the machine rolling at home, what have you. And you know, when does the connection with Closed Casket begin, and kind of like what was the road to what would be Cost of Living, the second LP?
At the time that we were put out our second split with a band called Unrestrained, which this dude Chris from Trip Machine, Hudson Valley, hit us up and asked us to do it. You know, we didn't know Unrestrained, but there was tumbleweeds rolling through Incendiary Town. Like, nobody was interested in us. We didn't have any label interest whatsoever. We didn't know how to go about doing that. And I kind of like always had my eye on Closed Casket because, one, they were from New York. And so, like, I had just generally been aware of them. They put out some cool shit, you know, when I, like, you know, in this era, like pre-Incendiary, and I always liked like the vibe of the records, like the physical records and the artwork and everything. And so I had my eye on them, and I think I pinged Justin and was like, what's up? Like, you know, fan of the label. And then we kind of stayed in touch, and then he was like, you know, we should do something together. And we were like, we would love to, like, kind of had, you know, to be honest, had our eyes on CCA. And so, the first thing we did with him was the Zababa split in probably like 2012 or something like that.
Right. Yes. That sounds accurate. Yeah.
And to us, I mean, that was like, hell yeah. You know what I mean? That was like big time. We loved Zababa. They were like a real ass band. And we, you know, Justin just from the jump just became sort of like this, you know, I don't know, like a trusted advisor, you could say. And we realized that this was going to work really well.
Okay. So you see, the stepping stone was, you know, not to call it that, but like step one is this Zababa split. Cause that's the thing is that at the time, I also remember like y'all, it's like, oh, yeah, this is the band that does splits. Like, they have the record, which I may not even have known about. Which is weird because this is still also that time period with like internet and like even streaming where like that shit's kind of new.
Yeah.
So finding bands' discographies was almost a little word of mouth type at times.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense because the label folded mere months after we put it out. We weren't popular and didn't tour full time. So you didn't really like, I don't think you had your head in the sand. I mean, later on, it's funny, Justin re-released it and it's on shit now. I mean, looking back on it, I actually think the music's really good. I don't think the vocals are very good. I think the lyrics are good. Like just trying to be impartial and some people really love it, which I think rules, you know what I mean? Like I stand behind it. And the other thing about it is it was a time and a place. It was our band trying to come together and do something. And I think by and large for 2009, I'm pretty happy with it. So I'm glad it's out there, you know?
Well, I mean, like, the thing is I knew about the splits and I had booked y'all by that point.
Yeah.
But I was just like, yeah, they got a demo and they got like three splits. Like that was like what I thought. Like I didn't know that there was like a full length record until like, I think after Cost of Living comes out, someone's like, oh, this is their second LP. And I was like, what? I was like, they have a whole other LP. Like
we're like we became the opposite of most bands where like everyone loves a band's first record and then it kind of falls off. We like kind of had the opposite trajectory. I mean, to be honest with you, dude, the Scum split was big for us. Like, those are the songs that went over well. I mean, we had some Long Island centric stuff on Crusade that like did well, but out of state, like the Scum split, you're also talking about more internet stuff happening at that time. So I mean, and then the band was just like two different animals pre and post Cost of Living essentially.
Well, okay. So what year does Cost of Living come out? Is it 13?
I think it came out in 2013.
Okay. That seems accurate. So this is a, like, not blowing smoke up your ass. It's just like, it's an objective thing. This is a pretty iconic record of this time period and like the decade of like 2011 to 2020 for sure.
That's cool, man. Thank you.
Oh, I mean that I think that, but also like I know a lot of people think that. And just as like if I'm sitting back looking at the chess pieces like I'm not in the game, it is what it is. You know, like that's a giant record. And I do remember watching it take y'all from like solid for lack of a better term, like middle class band that can like have like a good set, you know, like a good modest set pretty much anywhere, to like headliner crazy set, you know, like what, like just wild reactions everywhere. To make that occur, what was sort of y'all's, I mean, like, again, planning is not usually the thing with Incendiary, but was like, what kind of went into this record? Like where were your,
I think there were a couple things. The first one is that by that time we like kind of gelled, right? Because it was like the same squad in the band. And so we were playing together a lot and I would say like radically on the same page about a lot of things. Like we were in lockstep with like everything, which is why we're still a band and conversely why bands break up, right? Like, you know, Timmy wants to be home with his girlfriend and Joey wants to be a rock star. And so the bands break up. Like that's what always happens. Right. And so we were just on the same page somehow, thankfully. And so at that time, I think, you know, we spent a lot of time on it. And it felt very, I felt like we were just like in our own world doing it. One of the things that happened with Cost of Living that's funny is like, just by the nature of it, of like recording, it was an extremely stressful recording process because we recorded in Jersey and we did it on like nights and weekends. And then like we would stay like kind of the same thing, like stay super late at the space and at the studio and then like go to work the next day. So I remember just being really tired. But the other thing that happened with it is, you know how like I feel like nowadays, like some stuff kind of like leaks out a bit and like you show your friends and you get like a copy of it like way in advance, and then maybe like nowadays there's like a couple singles released. I like nobody heard the record, like, so we had no idea what to expect, and then we kind of just like, here's the record, it came out. And so to have it go over well, I truly like didn't expect that at all. But a lot of it was just about like, I felt like we had it in us. We just actually took the time to write it that time.
Okay. So really like, it's like the magic was kind of in the familiarity of the team.
You know? Yeah, I think so. The team and the time that we spent, like one of the things that we do is because time is like the enemy of incendiary, particularly now, like, you know, we go in with like the record is like pretty much done. And so we weren't like in the studio tinkering. We like, this is the songs. Like we had it done. We spent a tremendous amount of time on it. I spend a lot of time on lyrics. You know, back then with like my stupid jobs, I would basically write like all of my lyrics at work because I had like, you know, like computer jobs. And so I think it was just like fully baked. And then we went in there and nailed it rather than like, there was nothing on the fly. There was nothing like we were ready to rock, you know?
That's the better way in general. I mean, like when I hear people like writing songs in the studio, like
Ace, I can't tell you how much that stresses me out.
Dude, just like I was about to say, bro, like the fight or flight in me like starts like rising up my spine when I hear that. Like I'm like, what do you mean? Like
I'm a planner. Yeah. I'm a planner, yeah.
So that you guys go in, gelled, you got the right team, you got the right ingredients, you know, you got the right label. And that comes out and it's huge. It's giant. Like, I just remember like, it was like, not to call it like overnight, but like, it's just, I mean, everybody's talking about this record. The songs are going over big as hell. I actually, you know what? It's interesting talking to you right now. I have a theory, on kind of like trains passing in the night and two things that kind of simultaneously happened that I think made y'all really resonate with people for a very good reason. And I think about this a lot. So y'all come out with that record. And one of the things that I feel like that was going on at the time within hardcore, I'm speaking broadly here, so anybody that was in a band at this time period, like, you know, relax, like, so was I. It's like subject matter was broadly like limited to kind of like a few things. On this record, you're speaking a lot about, you know, political and societal things that like your capital H hardcore fan probably wasn't engaging with, but so much at the time. And specifically police brutality, you know, and I think one thing that occurred that I remember thinking was I was like, here's a band that was talking about something within this subculture that wasn't being talked about like with the specificity that you guys were doing it. And then the zeitgeist, no pun intended with the record, the zeitgeist of the world, within a couple years later, is everybody's talking about that. And, yeah, you know, I saw, from like a chess player standpoint, I was like, here are two stars kind of passing one another at the same time. To kind of like culminate in this like sort of like this explosion, because like maybe you have somebody that's like young, like that doesn't know hardcore that well, but they see shit on the news, you know, they see that kind of brutality and stuff on the news, and then they hear your band and they're like, boom, here's a band talking about how I feel. I don't know, I just from an observational standpoint, I was like, how special is that
No, that's awesome.
For an unfortunate reason, being the subject matter, but still, it's like you kind of gave like a theme song to people's outrage.
Yeah, I mean, that song I wrote because like I felt motivated to write it. I did not think it would be like a popular song at a show in a live setting. Which is interesting. Like, I think like, I mean, I guess if I have to like look back on it now, it's been like 8 years. I just was like frustrated with like the state of the state and felt like I tried very hard to convey that frustration as a young person, particularly a young person in like, you know, in a metropolitan area, what I was going through. And that writing in that style seemed to me like what hardcore was, unless you were actually, you know, a real ass dude, which we were not. We were not tough. We were not from a rough area. And I came from a time that like the bands that wrote about that were actually like that and were sketchy dudes and were tough. And like, and so I was never going to front on that side of things because that wasn't me, you know what I mean? Right. And so I just, this is kind of like what came out because this is really the lens that I looked at hardcore through, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, and you know, that's something that I implore any hardcore musician, any musician period, but like specifically within our world, it's like, you know, it seems simple, but if your life is guns and drugs and, you know, getting it in the street, write about that. If your life is not 100%, don't write about that. You know, like, it's like, write about like write your truth, man. Like you talk about, you said something specific. You said, you came up in a time period where the people that were writing about that were actually living it. And, you know, and that's the thing is that, which indicates that there's a time period where people started doing that. They weren't actually living that way. They were just trying to kind of emulate something. I didn't grow up hard, you know, myself. So I never wrote about like brandishing a gun or, you know, like living hard in the streets or whatever. And, but some people do that. And, simply put, don't do that. You know, like, just write about like what's actually going on in your life.
And I get it, man. If I was like writing lyrics is hard, and when you're frustrated, and particularly if you're a young person, if you are, you know, 17, 18, perhaps you're not the best writer, and so some stuff that's going to come out is going to be about some drama and stuff. Same thing about writing about girls or boys or whatever. Like,
of course.
It makes total sense to me. I just like, I felt like that was like kind of the, I guess like maybe like the easy way out in some ways.
Yeah. Well, you're also a little older at this point too.
For sure.
So yeah, it's like you have a better head about it where you're like, this is my life. This is the day to day. Cause that's the thing, man. It's like that is what I want to hear. Like I want to hear about somebody talking about like actually living through the hardship of our time period. You know, and cost of living down to the name, you know, like that kind of does like bring up sort of anxieties about like the current time period and like, you know, how like difficult it is to pay for, you know, like just surviving.
I mean, anxiety about the current time period is basically like, that's what the lyrics are more or less about to me, like that, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, you know, that comes later too, like with the songs like The Product Is You.
Yeah.
You know, but so, you know, this happens and kind of like, all right, you talked about how demand did not exist before. Does demand exist now?
For sure. Yeah, totally, totally different, you know, experience that we were not ready for or rather not expecting. And at this time, you know, But again, now we're like approaching 30, right? And Dan's like 31 or 32. And so it's like, all right. And meanwhile, of the last 5-6 years, we're having a great time, but we're also getting older and things are changing. And so I think we still really push it here, like post cost of living. We don't play 200 shows by any stretch of the imagination, but we do some runs. We really push it. This is like the true time of like, you know, flying to LA and then getting back at like 2 a.m. and going to work, or like a couple times where we would come back on Monday mornings and like go straight to work and stuff like that. Oh, yeah. All that sketchy stuff, like constantly going to work with no voice, like all that stuff. So yeah, I mean, we tried to carpe diem, man. Like we tried to seize the day and do as much as we could. And at that time it really transferred wow, I wonder how long this is going to last. Like we better try to, you know, do as much as possible.
Oh, so even still it's like, oh yeah, you're thinking people aren't going to, you know, this isn't going to be forever, you know, kind of thing. Like you're approaching.
Yeah. I mean,
you know,
partly because I grew up listening to hardcore and that's what happens a lot of time. True, you know what I mean? True. Like, I think that's one aspect of it. But yeah, it was an incredible experience after that for sure. We went to Europe for the first time, I think right after this, or actually, you know, what's funny, like this is classic incendiary. I think we went to Europe for the first time, like legit a month before this record came out, which is kind of funny. So, yeah, but we did a lot of cool stuff around that time, man. It was awesome.
Yeah. And so, I mean, is your life away from Incendiary just still kind of, it's like still like the very seemingly very chill clip that it's going at, or is anything kind of changing up there?
Let me think. I'm still in Brooklyn, but like I met, you know, the woman who's now my wife. So, you know, I'm with her, and still kind of like doing things, kind of taking my career a little bit more seriously at the time.
Okay.
And thinking about maybe like playing rugby again, kind of putting that to the side and just like working and, you know, trying to stay like physically fit and sane. And yeah, I don't know. Like my life was very much like consumed by, honestly, like doing the band at that time.
I mean, I imagine with as popular as the record is, it's, I feel like it would be kind of hard, you know, to be too far away from it. So, I mean, trajectory for you guys just at this time period, 2013, 14, 15, it's just going up, up, up. You know, I feel like people increasingly can't get enough of you. Because here's the thing too, you have a hot product, but you're also not overselling it. What I mean by that is that like you're not going on 2 month long tours. Like yeah, it's still like people can only see you chance encounters, you know? So I mean like because it doesn't happen all the time, I feel like people are even more feverish about it.
I think it helped unquestionably. I think it by no means was a strategy, but it definitely helps. I mean, scarcity helps in almost anything in terms of one's perceived value of it, right? So yeah, that was definitely in our favor. And we could, the other thing that happened and that is a product of not doing the band for a living is you can do dumb things that make no sense for shows. You can fly to, you know, Houston for a one-off to lose money because it doesn't matter because you saved your band money. And so you can do all these things and that kind of morphed into our like model of like maximum reach and like travel in as little amount of time and doing things that don't make sense. And I don't even, it's just mean that like in the context of like shows and travel. I also mean like in the stuff we do in New York, like let's fly out our friend's band and make way less money on this so we can play with our friend's band and it's cooler. You know what I mean? Like it allows us to kind of do like whatever we want. And when you don't have the existential threat of album cycles and paying for your rent based on how many t-shirts you sell. And not, by the way, like not to look down on that stuff, like by any stretch of the imagination. It's just there is an upside to just kind of doing it for the love of the game, so to speak.
Dude, I mean, as someone who does it for the love of the game, I fucking get it. And I just everything you're saying, I'm like, oh, yes, I know this well. Like, like this sort of type of operation of being like, all right, well, we want to play this, so fuck it. Let's just buy plane tickets and play it, you know, or and like with like money saved, or it's like, ah, like, let's set this band up that lives across the country and see if, you know, we can, you know, throw them on something, you know, whatever. Kind of it what it is what it really is it is a working man style of doing a band, honestly.
Yeah, that's precisely what it is. That's what resonated with me, and it was also just like I think we just have a extreme level of stubbornness where it's like we will make this work, like no matter what.
Yes, yes, I absolutely love that energy. So you guys, you know, like are do this for like a few years, and this is like, you know, like you're playing overseas. I think you go to Japan in this time period. Does that come later?
We go to Japan after Thousand Mile Stare.
Okay. So, and what year is Thousand Mile Stare out?
2017.
Okay. Okay. I'm just trying to get my timeline right. So, you know, you, in between, you know, like this record and that record, it's obviously like every gig you're playing, it's gold. You know, you're doing all the things that you're talking about, like just, you know, at your own will, like going, playing, you know, wherever, if you guys are available, and then, you know, and getting people to come to y'all, you know, following up a record as hot as Cost of Living, you know, what are you thinking? Are you thinking you can do it? Or, you know, kind of like what was the general vibe of the band?
Probably the first time in Incendiary that I ever felt pressure. Like we did feel pressure on this one, like for sure. And it was, we take a long time to write. It took a while to write. It was like a little less, it was a, like slightly probably more stressful, but the recording process was less painful and more real and more pro and more, you know, we had a little bit more time to play with, and we kind of like learned from our mistakes.
Right.
And I, you know, that was the record that like I always wanted to put out, so to speak, you know what I mean? And so working with Will was a great experience. And I think he was a big positive influence on us. And I think by and large, our focus was to start writing like more songs, like actual songs. And I think we still are on like a focus of doing that. And so, yeah, I that was the first record. I mean, like, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm pretty like pretty critical of things and particularly of myself, but that record, like, I'm thrilled with how it came out.
Was that Will Yip or was it somebody else?
It was Will Putney, although we did Will record Putney. With okay, Will wow. Yip. Yeah, we did, and I love Will. We did record with Will Yip previously, but the full length was in Will Putney in Jersey.
Beautiful. Okay. All right. I remember Will Putney being the person for this one now. Okay, yes. So you go into this one, you know, not to say that Cost of Living wasn't intentional, but you go into this one even more intentional in regards to like songwriting, and, you know, kind of like being the well-oiled machine that y'all already are. You know, this one comes out, and do you feel like with your interaction with like Incendiary fans and everything, do you feel this one did what you wanted it to do?
Yeah, I think so. I think so too. I think that if a piece of music or a record or an album or a song like resonates with people, it's always going to resonate with people. And just because something new doesn't as much, like, doesn't really take away from anything, I don't think. So yeah, I also think like a lot of things have to do with people's like step into music. And most people, the first thing they hear from a band is going to be the one that sticks with them and that resonates with them most, right? Like, that's what usually happens. And so I was thrilled with how it went over, because I did feel like Cost of Living got a pretty good reaction. And so I think as long as this doesn't bomb, I'll be happy. And I think people by and large liked it. I think a lot of people like Cost of Living, or some people maybe, I don't have a great sense of this, like Cost of Living more, which I think is awesome. And that doesn't bother me at all. As long as, you know, it wasn't any kind of like thing that people hated. But at the same time, like, we weren't really trying to, like, I feel the third LP is the one where like some wacky stuff can start happening.
Sure.
And we were hyper conscious of not doing that.
Right. No, I think that record is a continuation of what y'all were already doing. Like in a way where it's like, I can think of songs on that record that I'm like, I like just as much as songs on Cost of Living. So in that sense, it's like, okay, like, it's not like they changed their sound up or anything.
Right.
It's just, they kept doing Incendiary, just like, you know, going down the, like, not, no change in it. It's like, you know, you went in there with like, you know, better songwriting, but like no change in like quality of like, oh, this song is sick, you know, kind of thing.
I think that's kind of like how we approached it. I mean, like, there were certain things, like, for me personally, like as like a vocalist and a lyricist, I wanted to improve upon. And I think by and large I did.
Yep.
And like, to me personally, obviously. Yep. So that was like a big thing for mine. So I was like, it was a very satisfying record for me in that regard.
Yeah, there is something about it that does feel a little more like, it's like the same band as Cost of Living, but it feels like a tiny bit more elevated for some reason. I don't really know what it is. I'm probably not like good enough with the nuance of things like that in order to figure it out. But
je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, something, man. I don't know, and it might be that songwriting thing you're talking about, like. I'm not sure. I'm gonna have to listen to them back to back, like this week, to kind of like see if I can put my finger on it. But that comes out, and I feel like, just observationally, the train just keeps rolling. Like, you know,
yeah,
like, people are still climbing. Like you said, didn't make anything dip. Like, you know, maybe if anything, it got you guys even more fans. I don't. To be real, there's this time period, it's tough to figure out, because it just seems like. Like, the easy button on a show is, oh, if Incendiary's playing it, game over. Like, it's popping off, you know, kind of thing. Because like, yo, I've had the pleasure of seeing y'all a bunch, and an even more of a pleasure of playing with y'all a good amount as well. And it just seems like that. It just seems like, you know, like, hey, like, they're playing, kids are showing up. I remember something that Eric told me. When he moved to New York, is that he would go see you guys, and he'd be like, yeah, I'll go see Incendiary, and people will show up that I see at nothing else, but they will be at like the sold out Incendiary gig.
For sure.
Which is interesting.
I think it's awesome.
Oh yeah. Like, having your own contingency like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think at that time, you know, there were a couple things. Like, we were offered some cool shows that I think turned us on to people, which I think is awesome. And so, like, you know, a couple, whether it's like, you know, like This Is Hardcore or whatever, we played UB. Like, so there were a few things like that. And then we played, I feel like, more, like, we physically played more shows. We tried to do as much as possible. Right. But yeah, man, I at this point it felt really good. I would be straight up lying to you to not say, like, around this time is where it became somewhat difficult to continually turn down opportunities.
Yeah.
And I think everyone's kind of struggled with that in their own way. But now you're talking about 2017. So, like, you know, we're like in our like mid 30s at that point.
Yep.
And this is where it just wasn't really like, you know, I had been I had been like married for 3 years at this point, like something like, all right, I'm going to quit my job. Like that wasn't a thing, but you know, just to be like real with you, that was a little bit difficult, around this time.
I'm sure, because I mean, especially with like how popular you are, it's the kind of thing where it's like, you know, end of the day, you're like, could I just do this as my job? Probably. With this many people showing up to stuff and going this crazy, and like the what the numbers look like you got to think to yourself, it's like, I do love doing this. I could probably do this just all the time.
Yeah, I think it. I don't know if a Road Dog Incendiary works. I really don't. I don't know if it works for like a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have like the mental state for tour. I don't know if people like who haven't toured, listen, I'm not in Black Flag, but like I've played a lot of shows, like how boring touring is. And I'm someone who kind of like can't sit still and likes to do a lot of things. And touring is so boring and mind numbing that like, I don't know how I would do with it mentally if we had, you know, like I say, the 200 show a year thing.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of aspects of like, just like, I don't know, leaving it all on the field that like, I don't know how it would have worked. You know what I mean? I think kind of everything worked out for a reason on that front, but there were certain opportunities, some things that, you know, cut a little deep sometimes over the years.
Oh, I'm sure. Cause it's like, I'm sure that's like, all right, like, here's an opportunity for y'all, but you're going to have to be gone for X amount of time. And because you know that's not part of y'all's operation, it's like, all right, I guess we got to say no. And I'm sure some of those definitely sucked.
Yeah, for sure, dude. Yeah,
I don't doubt it at all. And I'm sure they still come in on a regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, like, they do. I think by now we've like kind of been forged our own path and are kind of like independent in a lot of ways and just have things down and are aligned to try to do what we can. But yeah, and but I also think like the proverbial secret's out on us too, right? Like, you know, the I think bands know our deal, and some bands are still like so awesome and accommodating and like try to ask us to do shit. And if we can, we'll make it work. We always like, you know, are really appreciative of that.
Sure, of course. So, you know, like you said, this time period in your life, you've been married, are you still living in Brooklyn or?
Yep, still living in Brooklyn.
Rock and roll, still living there, doing this when you can, you know, still working. I've always known you as you know, a working man. I've never known you not to.
Yeah, I became like pretty busy in like my career and stuff in media, and so that like really took off. I didn't really, like I said, like I told you, I didn't really take that side of things that seriously when I was younger, and then it just kind of snowballed, and so that wound up taking like an increased portion of my life. But you know, it was a good time. We were in Brooklyn. People in the band started moving to Brooklyn. Brian moved to Brooklyn. Rob moved to Brooklyn. Discovered like, you know, Muay Thai and kickboxing, from becoming friends with Gavin Van Black. Shout out Gavin from legendary guitar player from Burn, for those who don't know, and getting really into doing that, and like just trying to expand into other things while still doing Incendiary and loving it.
Again, keeping up the Brendan way of just doing 1,000 things at one time.
Pretty much, yeah. Often to my detriment, but that's kind of how I like to roll.
Yeah, I hear that too. So, you know, I guess you get a couple years of the record, and then, you know, the beginning of 2020 occurs. And I know you played some shows then because we were together.
Yep. But
then the world stops.
Yeah. Yeah, that was crazy because we had some big plans, and I mean, every band did, or most bands did, but that obviously went away. So that was weird. I feel like we were one of the bands who played like as in our band and your band, like pretty close to COVID popping off.
Yeah. End of February.
Yeah. End of February. Like that's pretty, that was pretty close to it. So yeah, our last gig was in ATL. And then, you know, COVID was weird. Being in the city for COVID was super weird and sucked. And then the only thing that, you know, that was good is that we just, like every other band in the world, we decided that we could use this time to kind of write, because I think, you know, when you're looking at, if you think of us from our position, you're talking about three LPs, all these splits, which are like six, seven, eight songs to add up to. And then it's a lot of material for a hardcore band. And so I'm already like, all right, like, you know, we're a little bit like, do people even want another record? Like, are we going to do this again? And, but I think we kind of got the itch, the quarantine itch, so to speak.
Sure.
And, you know, it's been fun to kind of like look at that again.
Okay. So you guys are working on more material.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Okay. Gotcha. And like, is recording time booked at all for that? Or is it still kind of in like a longer writing process?
It's a little bit of a, yeah, I mean, it's been a long writing process, but that's kind of how we roll. Nothing's booked yet. No, like super hot Form of Passion, like media exclusives, but like, no, we're chilling, dude. We're working on stuff, and I do feel the same pressure now, like doubly. And so I think we're just like, we're enjoying writing again. I think the thing is you don't want writing to feel like a job. I never want it to be like that. Yeah. Because it's literally not a job for us. And that must suck dealing with that. But like, now that it's like fun again and we got the itch again, let's take advantage of it. That's basically our outlook.
Have you, like, during the time period that you like weren't able to play, especially because this has been like, albeit like not as much as other bands, but a very regular clip for you for a very long time, kind of, what did you do with yourself kind of in the time period where you weren't able to play?
I mean, I was lucky enough to be able to work from home. So I was one of those people that, you know, fared okay during COVID, which I was, you know, pretty thankful for. So I had that, and, you know, I was trying to stay healthy, man. I was trying to stay physically healthy and mentally healthy. And so I think this is a time of stress, known or unbeknownst, for every person going through this. And a lot of it was trying to keep my mind right, and to try to get outside, and to try to get exercise, and to try to be, you know, like just staying like mentally and physically healthy. You know what I mean?
Sure. No, but I mean, but of course, I mean, I try to do the same myself. So, you know, it's, you're working from home, you're trying to stay sane by getting out of the house, and keeping your body in check. Not letting that go, which over the quarantine was hard to do.
Yeah, I really do feel like not enough emphasis is like placed on that, like how difficult this is for every single person. You know what I mean? Like in a variety of ways. And yeah, man. I think, by the way, I don't mean this from like a woe is me standpoint, quite the opposite. I've been super lucky during this. It's just like, I think, you know, being easy on one's neighbor and trying to realize that like everyone is like experiencing this unprecedented thing in a really weird time and a really difficult time for a lot of people. So, you know, it was hard for me early on with it. I had some like deaths in the family, and that was rough to like deal with, like literally during the height of COVID. But, you know, by and large, it was a focus on trying to stay healthy and make sure, you know, other people were okay.
That's putting you that's approaching it from a positive place, and that's good. So, you know, as things developed over that time period of you know, like the paused world, you know, as things have trickled back over the past few months, you know, and I've seen some shows get announced, you know, with y'all on them. Have you guys played again yet?
We were supposed to play in Chicago with Knocked Loose, and
that's right.
we got stuck during the hurricane that hit New York City, which is a whole other story that sucked and straight up sucked the life out of us. But we did not make it there, which was on another level of frustration for so many reasons, but particularly with our band, where we put all the stuff, you know, all our eggs into one basket and we're so excited to play. And then to not have that happen was super frustrating.
Of course. I mean, like, were any of y'all like directly affected by the hurricane?
No. Everyone was okay. We were just stuck there. It's kind of a long story, but we are, you know, we weren't able to fly out. We were, told not to rebook because our flight was going to be booked the next day. Delayed. And then our flight was canceled the next morning. And by that time, all flights were booked out to Chicago. A nice little fuck you on top was that all of our equipment was able to get added to a flight to Chicago and made it to Chicago. So,
son of a bitch.
You know, I like to think hopefully they had a good time in the Windy City for the day, but we did not make it.
I hate that for y'all, man. But
yeah, it's all good. It sucked. Knock Loose was, you know, has been so cool to us, and we felt like shit not being there. We do have some shows coming up, which is cool. So I'm looking forward to that. We have, you know, a show in Brooklyn with God's Hate and Age of Apocalypse, and then we're playing up in Boston, and that's our first Brooklyn show in a couple of years. So it's going to be great.
When is that Brooklyn show?
I think it's November 5th.
Okay.
And then in Boston the next day. Yeah. It's November 5th.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. So like beginning of November, couple of those. And, you know, I mean, and like, you know, I'm sure we'll see some other, you know, some other things from y'all pop up, you know, now that, we're able to somewhat come out of our holes.
Yeah. I think, for us, like we're in writing mode, dude. That's like, we're full on.
Good. So, I mean, so again, more things for people to look forward to, but, That takes us to, like, you know, pretty much like right now. And, you know, it's like the opportunity is there for the future, and y'all are a staple of the contemporary genre. So it's, I'm sure people are very excited about that and are excited to see y'all at y'all's comeback shows. Is there anything as a man of great lyrics, is there anything that you want to leave the people with?
Oh, geez. I mean, anyone who made this long into the podcast, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me, man. We're still trying to keep the train on the tracks. We're all getting old here, but we still really love doing it and have been just, you know, it's been a blessing, and we're going to keep repping Long Island forever, and, you know, keep your eyes peeled eventually for hopefully some new tracks, man.
Beautiful. I'm excited about all of it. It's been wonderful talking to you, sir. And I really hope I see you soon.
Ace, it was a pleasure, man. I really enjoyed speaking with you, and thanks so much for having me.
As always. Everybody, if you want to support this podcast, you can subscribe at www.patreon.com/formofpassion. Look forward to seeing you over there. We'll catch you next time.